While mostly known for its organisation in the US, the Revolutionary Industrial Workers of the World Union has a significant history on the other side of the world, in Australia, where IWW members organised strikes and sabotage, winning improvements for coal miners, fruit pickers, sheep shearers and others, and helped stop conscription to the army during World War I. This is Working Class History.
Come listen, all kind friends of mine, I want to move a motion to make an Eldorado here. I've got a bonza notion. Bump me into Parliament, bounce me any bleeding way, bang me into Parliament on next election day.
Today we're going to be talking about the history of the IWW Union, also known as the Wobblies, in Australia. We introduced the Union in our episode 6, so if you're not acquainted with basic info about the Union, I'd go back and listen to that first. We are very pleased to be joined by Paula De Angelis, a contributor to Wobblies of the World, a global history of the IWW, who, like Verity Bergman, wrote a chapter about the Australian Wobblies for the book. The IWW was a revolutionary syndicalist union. This means that, instead of political parties or the ballot box, they saw direct action by workers at the point of production as being the most effective tool for social change. To start off with, Paula tells us about the historical background of the formation of the union in Australia.
So the best place to start that story is with the maritime strike of 1890. It started with the officers in the Merchant Marine. So it came from the trade union movement, the craft union movement, and it spread to a lot of other industries, and it was a disaster for the union movement here in Australia because the state here deployed all of its weapons against it to crush that strike. And so it ended in a very bad failure, and all those workers had their wages cut by 30%. So in response to that, the Australian trade union movement set up the Labor Party and a whole other bunch of related institutions that were about giving the working class a voice within the state and within the parliamentary process so that it couldn't be deployed against them again in that way. We had a Labor Party here functioning for 20 years, and in fact, Labor governments. It was a very successful party, and the time the Wobblies were formed, the Labor Party was in power. The Australian trade union movement was basically an outpost of the British trade union movement. So another thing that you have developing out of there is something that is called, in Britain, is called New Unionism. So in 1889, there was a strike on the London docks. So what that dealt with was unskilled and semi-skilled workers. And in the United States, you've got a history there of a very strong conflict between skilled and unskilled workers. But in Britain and Australia, people like Ben Tillett and Keir Hardie and Tom Mann realised and advocated for bringing skilled and unskilled workers into the ranks of the trade union movement. The Australian context for the development of the Wobblies came under that area. So the Wobblies were in, the socialist movement was incorporated into the trade union movement that way. And we had a form of industrial unionism here, which was essentially Labor Party control. It was hierarchical and top down, but the idea of bringing unskilled labourers of a certain type into the one union and a whole industry that already existed, and it had been incorporated into the political process here. You still have a similarity of situation in the sense that unskilled labourers, all of the workers that came out of the Second Industrial Revolution, which is basically the invention of steel, there's still a difference in the way they're regarded. The trades union movements, the skilled workers unions, came from an earlier era of the Industrial Revolution where the worker was at the centre of the production process. All of the workers who joined the Wobblies and who throughout the world joined the syndicalist movement, right, which the Wobblies were connected to, they were dock workers, they were labourers, and it was basically the difference is the way you were paid and the way you were hired. You know, in the United States, the trade union movement, the craft unions there, assumed that those workers were unorganisable. In Britain and in Australia and New Zealand, in anywhere in the British dominions, the union movement tried to control those workers, bring them into their own ranks. You have to remember that Australia is not really a country in this sense, particularly not back then. It was an outpost of British colonialism. Most of the people here, they saw themselves as British. We were a British colony. Our entire economy is geared towards being a British colony, so we exported raw materials. In a sense, the only type of workers you have here are industrial workers. So if you take construction into account, all of the skilled workers, you know, there's not a manufacturing base. In America, you had your own manufacturing base, you had your own markets. It was all very internal. There was a lot going on, but our economy has always been directed outwards.
In 1910, Australia got the world's first Labour Party government and the first Social Democratic National Government. Part of the reason for the popularity of the IWW were the failings of parliamentary socialism to bring real positive change for working people. This was well illustrated by the case of Billy Hughes.
He came from the union movement. Billy Hughes set up an industrial union within the Labour Party, and that was the Waterside Workers' Federation. And he used that to get to power, became prime minister. And then from the union point of view, he turned on the working class. He cut wages. He tried to introduce conscription. He did over his own members. He sent in strike breakers, all of those kinds of things. Like if you ask anybody in Australia, that's hissing and spitting. Billy Hughes.
That dirty little traitor, Billy Hughes, is trying to introduce that damn conscription for boys and for men. And of course, for him we've no use. He's a viper, a dirty low skunk. It's a pity the ship never sunk. When he sailed.
The US IWW was formed in 1905. The first branch in Australia was established 2 years later.
Initially, the Australian Wobblies were set up through the Democratic Socialist Party, which these days is kind of referred to as the DeLeonite wing of the IWW. They were clubs. They were socialist clubs, basically. So they were little propaganda groups, and they were set up around Australia. But industrially speaking, sort of what happened was, I'm sure Peter went into the split, the initial split between the DeLeonite, the Chicago and the Detroit model. That was reflected here to some extent, although the Australian Wobblies were more syndicalist from the beginning and much more cynical about political action because of all of those experiences with the Labor Party and the way the Labor Party had been incorporated into the government and, you know, sold out the workers. They were more anti-political anyway. And then when the 1908, the Chicago version of the Wobblies was set up, there was a group here in Adelaide who chartered to that organisation. So the administration was initially here in Adelaide. And they had direct connections to specifically coal miners and also maritime workers. There were direct political connections between the US and the Australian IWW. For example, William Troutman, who was one of the founders of the leadership in the IWW in the United States, he was actually New Zealand born and the son of German immigrants to New Zealand. In 1905, when initially the IWW was being set up, he made a trip to Australia. He came back and spread the word. So there were some direct propaganda connections in that sense and organisational connections, and they were maintained. And there was also a sort of parallel movement. You know, industrial unionism comes from an earlier generation. The Western Federation of Miners were well known here. Coal miners tend to travel around from coal mining town to coal mining town. So there were a lot of direct connections. And that comes up in our book because Peter Clayworth talks about his subject is Pat Hickey, who, you know, came from a New Zealand coal mining town and ended up working in Colorado in the coal mining town. So you go where the work is. So you had a lot of Canadians and Americans or, you know, Europeans who'd spent time in Canada and the United States coming through Australia all the time. So they kept the connection. The Australian Wobblies imported a lot of literature from the United States. So there's a sort of a rank and file influence going on. The people would turn up and erate and spread the literature around, bring it with them on the ship. I think it's an excellent example of the way that the IWW thought globally and acted locally, because all of those workers brought with them their experiences of direct action in Canada, in Ireland, in the United States, and adapted it to what was going on in front of them here in Australia. Historically speaking, in terms of the way that they enacted what they were doing, they went in quite a different direction because they were responding to local conditions. And that was what syndicalism is all about.
Perhaps unlike the American IWW, whose founders were mostly born in the US, it appears that most of the founders of the Australian branch were immigrants.
In a sense, you look at all of those leading Wobblies, they were from Ireland, they were from Scotland. They weren't really immigrants. They're Australians, as much as any Australians are. There were quite a few Wobblies that were Australian-born. Monty Miller was Australian-born, and Bill Beattie was Australian-born. And it sort of didn't matter back then. You know, that's how the British were. If you were part of the British Empire, you were British. You were a British citizen. Leading on from that, I think there is actually quite a lot of evidence that the influence of immigrants in the United States on the Wobblies has been underestimated, because a lot of the early Wobbly history was about promoting how American they were. But in reality, the various ethnic and immigrant communities in the United States had an enormous influence. The silk strike in Paterson, for example, you know, the reason that strike was so successful, and that's one of their more famous strikes, was because there was an Italian immigrant anarchist community there that had been there for, you know, generations, and they'd already organized the community. The Wobblies kind of just tapped into that. So, you know, that kind of evidence pops up all the time if you go back over it. You know, we're a country of immigrants. so whether you were Australian born or not sort of was irrelevant. Irish names, Scottish names, all of those things. You know, Verity talks about how many Scotsmen and Irishmen there were in it, but that was the trade union movement. You know, the Scots and the Irish were the backbone of the Australian trade union movement.
The Australian IWW organised in many ways which were similar to the US, but which differed in some key aspects.
The basic principles and tactics of the Australian IWW were the same as the ones in the US. They organised direct action at the point of production. You can see particularly if you look in Queensland, and a lot of this has been hidden history until recently, there was a group of itinerant workers who followed the seasonal work. They went mining, and then they went shearing, and then they went fruit picking, and they would work their way up and down the east coast of Australia. So they were a very similar kind of grouping to the agricultural workers organisation, which is, you know, a lot of what people think about when they think about the US Wobblies, you know, that whole hobo kind of mythology, and they were the Australian version. So where they were mostly single, they were mostly men, they travelled together, they lived together in horrible conditions. So there's stories of those guys taking the kind of sabotage direct action where the shearers, who were very militant, set fire to their accommodation in order to force the boss to build better accommodation. They did all of that sort of stuff. They also got involved in free speech fights. There were several of those. Tom Barker, who's my subject in the book, talks about getting involved in free speech fights so that they were free to soapbox and speak in the Sydney domain. So that happened right in the middle of Sydney. And he really enjoyed that. A lot of those things were similar. The major difference, I think, in the method of organisation was the relationship that they had with the craft unions, with the trade union leadership. Because as I said before, they were much more incorporated into the trade union movements here. There was they were sort of regarded as the lefty extreme, and right? down there with the Socialist Party and people like that, but they were part of the movement. They weren't excluded from it the way they were in the United States. The other major difference was the development of the European war. World War One is what people mostly call it, which I feel is inaccurate, but the Wobblies got involved in that era in what you might call a very political campaign. The US IWW sort of took no position on World War One. The idea that they were anti the war was used by the state in the United States to repress them, but they sort of really weren't, because it didn't affect them industrially.
Another significant difference was that union density in Australia was much higher, at around half the workforce, compared with only around 12% in the US. And many workers had to be members of craft unions in order to get employment at union workplaces. So most Wobblies in Australia were dual members of both the IWW and other unions. Paula explains more about other activities the IWW undertook.
Most of the key leaders of the Wobblies spent their time in pretty much the same way that the organisers in the IWW in the US did. They took their literature and they travelled around and they got jobs and agitated while they were there, sold the literature, got fired usually, went on to the next job, agitated there. That happened all over the place. I mean, you know, there are identifiable industrial disputes that are in the record, like in Broken Hill, because Broken Hill was a coal mining community. So it was a very stable place. And basically the town was run by socialist miners. There were industrial disputes like that. The shearers got involved in a lot of industrial disputes. The leadership themselves and the ones that are in the historical record, basically what they did was popped into Sydney, picked up a whole bunch of literature, and then travelled the country soapboxing, organising, agitating, just like the Wobblies did in the United States. But they also ran, throughout the First World War, they ran daily political campaigns in Sydney mainly, not just Sydney but in Melbourne as well, and they were much more traditional propaganda demonstration campaigns. So there was a point in time there in the middle of the war where Tom Barker, who basically was, you know, the operations manager for the Sydney branch, the IWW had a hall in Castlereagh Street in Sydney, and he lived there and basically ran the show, served a whole bunch of purposes. And one of the things he was doing was organising daily protests against the war and conscription in the Sydney domain, where those things traditionally happen. So they did a lot of that too. I mean, that kept him busy. Right. And they were publishing direct action every week, and then for a while there every day. And that's what they're remembered for in Australian history. You know, a lot of that history that comes out of the shearers in Queensland and all of that stuff, that's more recent work. That's Rowan Day has uncovered a lot of that stuff. But the Wobblies that everybody knows in Australian labour history come from that Sydney branch. During the miners' strike, Tom Barker went to Broken Hill. I mean, it was an era where strikes were going on all the time, not just here, but also in the United States. And the Wobblies were always there.
Australian Wobblies were involved in too many disputes to list, but some of them included fruit pickers in Victoria getting a pay increase after the union threatened to destroy the fruit trees, miners in Broken Hill taking Saturday afternoons off to give themselves a 44-hour week, and then later going on strike for the 8-hour day, a strike which spread across the country. And in 1916, the IWW organised a slowdown in New South Wales railway workshops. One of my favourite ever political posters that I read about was put up by Australian Wobbly Rail Workers, and it basically said this: slow down. Slow work means more workers are needed. More workers means lower unemployment. Lower unemployment means greater demand for labour, which means higher wages for all. Now, that kind of radical analysis put forward in straightforward language appealed to large numbers of people. And as in the US, Australian Wobblies also created and fed a lively working class counterculture using things like music and cartoons.
Industrial workers of the world recognised the ways in which the working class communicated, and music was a very important part of that. You're trying to organise a group of people who don't necessarily speak the same language. They come from different industries. The cultural production was a very important part of, well, in the Smithsonian Institute, they call it organising tools. Music, the cartoons, the newspapers were all very much organising tools for the Wobblies. And that is because that is the way the working class communicated, shared information. And that's a very old tradition that goes back centuries, really. You know, and I think the reason that they, one of the major reasons that they had such an influence on working class history here and in the United States and in Canada is because they gave the working class a forum for their own cultural production. As far as they were concerned, all that stuff was there. It was workers who drew those amazing cartoons and made up those songs, and it kept everybody united. It was a method of solidarity, and that comes from their work experience. You think of industrial workers, unskilled workers, as, you know, society thinks of them as this kind of undifferentiated mass and interchangeable, and that was a very disempowering way of looking at it. The Wobblies, you know, turned that around. You can see it in the cartoons. It's always visually represented with the industrial worker being a big, strong, masculine, powerful figure, and capitalist being fat and awkward. Yeah. They were very much about promoting the self-sufficiency, the independence, the creativity of their own people. The cultural production was equally important here because there was no way to organise unskilled labourers without it. We happened to get some cultural geniuses, and so they have had a lasting effect. You know, Sid Nichols was an incredible artist. Same in the US, so they're the ones you remember. But the people were writing songs all the time. You can read the newspapers and people send them in. People write poems, you know, they're just workers. They take the time out from their, you know, night shifts or whatever to draw these beautiful pictures or write a poem, all of those kinds of things. And the Wobblies had a forum for publishing that, and they did. So, yeah, it was equally important. And the published bit is only the small part of the story. That's the bit we have left. They sang American songs as well. They would import the Little Red Songbook, you know, all of Joe Hill's songs, all of those. It didn't matter where the song came from, because they were true internationalists.
With the outbreak of World War I, the Australian IWW threw itself wholeheartedly into campaigning against the war, and in particular against conscription, at times organising public meetings of tens of thousands of people.
In Australia, the First World War had a very detrimental and profound effect on the economic situation of the working class here. That meant that the union had a responsibility, the Wobblies had a responsibility here to organise around that issue. It was an industrial issue, not a political one. They got very involved in that, and they were violently opposed to it. Yeah, whereas in the United States, the US IWW was very interested in what was going on with the war, and they basically took the position that it was a way of turning the working class into cannon fodder, right? That was their basic position on it. And they followed it. If you read the issues of solidarity from that era, they publish stuff about what's going on in Europe all of the time, but it didn't affect their economy, really. It wasn't part of their day-to-day lives. But here, the first and immediate effect was our exports dried up, which, you know, is an economic disaster, because after Britain, our second biggest importer of raw materials was Germany. So when war was declared, we immediately lost that part of the economy. The way that worked is we exported raw materials to Britain and they manufactured goods and sent them back here. That stopped happening as well because the British economy was entirely terms of war production. You can see that immediately, and the Wobblies would have seen this, there's a not just a life and death relationship in a direct sense of sending soldiers off to die, but the working class here claim very close to starving. The Wobblies were very opposed to the war, which most of the working class wasn't. I mean, I think that's an important point too. The trade unions supported Australia's entry into the war on patriotic grounds because we saw ourselves as British, huh? And that led to some strange and quite nasty effects. The unions voluntarily implemented a no-strike rule for the duration of the war. They saw it as their patriotic duty. Lots and lots of trade unionists signed up. They volunteered. The problem they had was with conscription, not really with the war, because we've got a long history with press ganging. The British tend to use coercive methods to get the working class to do what they want. And the trade unions are very well aware of that history. So they didn't want to give the government the power to conscript. And in fact, they saw that as a betrayal because they were doing their patriotic duty.
Right.
The Wobblies practiced coalition politics there. They were quite publicly opposed to the war itself. You know, it was an unbosses war. It was turning the working class in cannon fodder. That was a difference because the Wobblies devoted a lot of time to those anti-conscription campaigns, and that's what they're famous for, really, these days, I think, here, is the influence they had on preventing conscription from being instituted in Australia. There were two referenda, and both times the Australian population, despite the best efforts of the government, voted against instituting conscription, right down to the soldiers in the trenches who were there.
Probably the most famous Australian IWW poster read, "To arms, capitalists, parsons, politicians, landlords, newspaper editors and other stay-at-home patriots. Your country needs you in the trenches. Workers, follow your masters." This poster in particular led to Tom Barker's arrest, despite the fact it was cleverly worded to avoid calling on workers directly to refuse military service, which would have been a serious criminal offence. Another prominent Wobbly who was arrested in 1917 was the 84-year-old Monty Miller.
He lived in Western Australia, Monty Miller. He was an anarchist all of his life, lived well into his 80s. He was a writer, a philosopher, an excellent soapbox orator, and that's a very common characteristic with the IWW. And I think a big reason why they lasted is that they attracted orators and propagandists of enormous caliber. And Monty was one of them. And he was tall and charming and erudite. And when the Wobblies were established here, he joined because he was an anarchist and a syndicalist. He ended up being prosecuted several times and jailed for being a Wobbly in his 80s. He was very old when it all started. He was also hilarious. The Western Australian Wobblies, as often happens with Western Australia, developed their own history and their own relationship with the Western Australian government. So the Western Australian government used a bunch of repressive tactics, and one of them was to arrest and put on trial Monty Miller. And so he and his fellow Wobbly, whose name escapes me, they decided to defend themselves so they could cross-examine each other and turn the court into a farce, basically. So that was the kind of person he was. He was one of the legendary figures of the Australian Revolutionary Movement and came through the Wobblies. So he sort of has a status like Eugene Debs in the United States. A well-established career as an activist, as a revolutionary before the Wobblies came, and then he contributed to the establishment and spread Wobbly ideas. They were all, and you find this with the US, they were all characters in some fashion or another. Donald Grant had an enormous influence on the Labor Party in later years. He was a magnificent orator, according to all reports. Quite a few Wobblies became card-carrying members of the Communist Party, just as they did in the United States. you know, they disseminated the culture into that area as well.
As in probably every radical movement, women and LGBTQ people played an important role in the Union, which unfortunately there's not much written about in the historical record.
Just as there were in the United States, women played a key role in the IWW, which is something that's not necessarily reflected in the historical record. In particular, there was a woman here named Violet Wilkins, who was a very staunch member of the Wobblies, and Verity Bergman describes her as indefatigable. The Wobblies kind of came to an end here as a big movement in the 1920s. But she spent the rest of her life trying to revive it. She spent the whole rest of her life setting up branches and trying to get them to work and then doing it again. There's letters in the US IWW record, because that's where she would send her reports. No labor movement, no revolutionary movement works unless the women are contributing to it. And then that's particularly true of the kind of communities that the Wobblies sprang from, which were basically miners and dockers. There's a whole background story there that we don't know too much about, other than, you know, knowing prominent women who were opposed to the war, like Vida Goldstein and all of those sort of people. It's definitely a project worth investigating. As far as sexual minorities go, the most notable example that you're bringing up here is the story of Charlie Reed. Verity and I did a book launch together a couple of months ago, and she mentions that because when she wrote that book at the time, she didn't know that Charlie Reed was gay. She found out because after she published Revolutionary Industrial Unionism, a descendant of his got in touch with her and passed on all of these letters, which were Charlie writing to his sailor partner, Carl Gunson. She really wanted to put that in. The thing about the Wobblies, and this is often brought up, is their remarkable lack of discrimination against minority groups of any kind. They were not into race lines, they were not into colour lines or gender or sexual lines. You know, it wasn't relevant. And that's because their value was universal class solidarity. The fact that you were working class overrode any other consideration. It didn't matter what country you came from, it didn't matter what your sexual preferences were, it didn't matter if you were a man or a woman. If you were working class and class conscious, you were one of them. Yeah, if you weren't class conscious, you still had the potential to be. You know, that's the way they operated, and I think that's what allowed that sort of flexibility in the movement. To do them credit, that carried on into the Australian Communist Party, that sort of value. And Charlie Reeve, I'm pretty sure, ran a bookshop in Melbourne for like decades and was part of the left-wing scene there.
While the IWW didn't appear to say much specifically about the rights of Indigenous people in Australia, a number of Aboriginal people were involved in the Union, although unfortunately it would be very difficult to determine the extent of this, as the Union didn't record people's ethnicity, and British colonial policy was to essentially erase Indigenous culture and give anglicised names to Indigenous people, often who were abducted from their families.
There were a pair of brothers here in Adelaide around the First World War and in the 20s. They had incredibly Irish names, and they were well known as soapbox orators in this area. And they probably had a presence in the shearers' unions. You know, a lot of Aboriginal people worked in the industries up there, up north. I suspect that a lot of those people had an influence on the Australian Communist Party position, which was very advanced and anti-colonialist. There's definitely an anti-colonial threat in the Australian IWW, and so they would have seen supporting, you know, Indigenous rights and Aboriginal people as part of that, because they were, again, working class. They were being done over by the British Empire. Everybody else was also being done over by the British Empire. That's the position that the Australian Communist Party took. say. And then the Wobblies were a very strong underground kind of influence in the Australian Communist Party. Very little is known about them, and partly because the Wobblies were colourblind to the extent that they didn't make a big deal of that kind of thing.
As in the United States, Wobblies in Australia came under attack by the authorities and the press.
I think you have a very similar set of responses to the authorities in the United States. It took some slightly different forms, but authorities here used the Wobbly opposition to the war in part to jail and deport. The most famous case was the IWW-12. They were accused of arson. So, you know, rounding up the leadership, putting them in jail, just like they did in the US, that happened. Deportation is a favourite tactic of the Australian government. We deport people all the time. They deported a lot of Australian Wobblies. Australian Wobblies of foreign extraction. They couldn't get away with deporting the locally born ones. Obviously, there were cultural campaigns and propaganda campaigns against them, associating them with foreign revolutionary ideas like Bolsheviks and all that sort of stuff that happened as well. There were a very similar set of tactics to the tactics that were used on the US.
The biggest single act of repression against the Union was the arrest of the IWW-12 in Sydney for crimes including treason, which was a hanging offence, as well as arson, sedition and forgery.
The IWW-12 were basically, they were the sort of core leadership of the Wobblies in the city. So the administration of the Wobblies had moved to Sydney by the stage. They were all very successful IWW leaders and organisers. The police here used a lot of the same tactics that the Department of Justice used in the United States. They would raid Wobbly halls. They would confiscate documents. They worked very hard to censor the mail. Getting Wobbly literature out through the post was really hard. So ultimately they rounded up 12 Wobblies, including some of their key leaders like Tom Glynn, putting them in jail, and they accused them of arson. And it was all a very dodgy court proceeding. They had a paid informant, basically. So it was a serious miscarriage of justice, but they were pretty much all given 20 years in jail. That galvanised the union movement, and so they were all actually released 4 years later, like 1920, 21. You know, a lot of people, like the subject of my chapter, Tom Barker, they were deported. He was deported to Chile, and there's lots of stories. There's an Australian historian who's written a whole book on how Australia deals with its social radicals by deporting them. It's an old British tactic. You know, the US and Australia both use it. There's situations where Wobblies were being deported from Australia to the American continent, and Wobblies from the American continent were being deported back to Australia, and the ships passed each other. Right? So the problem with being deported is you're in jail for a very long time first. And that was Tom Barker's experience. He was in jail in Albury in the middle of nowhere for 9 months or 10 months before he was deported. And it drove him a little nuts. So,
after conscription was defeated in October 1916, which the Labour Prime Minister Billy Hughes blamed on the IWW, he had the IWW declared an unlawful association. Then they banned their publication, Direct Action, from being sent through the post and later seized all copies of it. In 1917, again with the support of the Labour Party, the government strengthened the Unlawful Association Bill, meaning that anyone who couldn't prove they weren't a member of the union was sentenced to 6 months in prison. While this and other attacks largely led to the demise of the union as a significant force, Wobbly activists, ideas and tactics lived on.
The IWW here has never entirely demised. That period of time was really the only period of time where you might say they had an influence on the broader culture of Australia and they had a significant impact. After that, their influence becomes a little harder to track and a little more nebulous because the organisation itself was pretty much destroyed in terms of it being a viable union. But all of those people didn't go away. The split between the left and the right happened during the First World War, so that was already done. What happened here was, and I think this happened in the United States, all of those people looked for other ways to bring about the revolution. But it wasn't about the organization, it was about your agenda. And so what they did, and this happened in Britain too with the syndicalist movement, they moved on to the next form of organization. Again, the Wobblies weren't a vanguard. They followed what the working class decided to do. It wasn't the organization that was important. It was where the working class was going. A lot of those people joined the Communist Party. In an organizational sense, it was definitely the repression from the state that caused the demise of the union in that sense. It existed on paper for a long time. There was a branch in Melbourne, which was pretty much continuous, but it was mostly a little group of musicians and poets and people who were into the cultural aspect of it. There's no doubt, and it's the same in the United States. The IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, had an enormous influence way beyond their membership. A good piece of evidence for that at the time with direct action, you know, the Wobblies never had more than a couple of thousand members, but everybody read the newspaper. Everybody read Direct Action. You know, Direct Action had a circulation of thousands, you know, working class papers like that. It's not just the people who buy them that read them. Everybody reads them. They get passed around. The extent to which the Wobblies filtered into the working class culture, the trade union culture, the Communist Party culture, and connected up with Australian mythologies about the larrikin, the swagman. We like hobos here, you know. We're into troublemakers, all that sort of stuff. The Wobbly ethic intersected with Australian radical culture in an important way. I'm a red baby, so I was raised in the communist, you know, Marxist-Leninist tradition here in Australia. And I spent all of my life singing Wobbly songs without even really realising where they came from. They were all in the Mayday songbook. You know, and I would go to Mayday every year and I would sing these songs. And it was only much later when I started, you know, investigating history that I worked out where all this stuff came from. That's the Wobbly songs.
That's all the time we have for today. For our Patreon supporters, we have a bit of bonus audio where Paula tells the story of how the largely forgotten history of the IWW in Australia got rediscovered in the 1960s. For more Wobbly history, as well as our episode 6 that we mentioned, our episode 9 is about the later period in the union's history in the US, and episode 16 is about women in the early IWW. As always, we've got lots of footnotes with links to more information and further reading in the show notes, as well as where you can get Wobblies of the World. Massive thanks to our Patreon supporters who make this podcast possible. You can support us as well and get early access to episodes and other neat things like free and discounted merch at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Thanks also to Warren Fahey for permission to use his rendition of the Australian Wobbly song Bump Me Into Parliament. This episode was edited by Louise Barry. Catch you next time. Bend me into Parliament on next election day. I've read my Bible 10 times through, and wisdom justifies me. The man who does not vote for me, by Christ, crucifies me. Bump me into Parliament, bounce me any bleeding way. Bang me into Parliament on next election day.